Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello and welcome back to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's Private Equity Practice. Today, we're picking up where we left off with Eric Taylor, founder and CEO of Trident, and Jeff Roth, founding partner of Brewin Capital. If this is your first time hearing from Jeff and Eric, I recommend pressing pause on part B to check out part A of our conversation first. That episode went live a couple weeks ago, and you'll hear us discuss their respective backgrounds and firms, their sourcing models, and unexpected value creation methods. It's a great primer for sure for what we're going to discuss today. We're going to take it a step further here in part B and hear Eric and Jeff's point of views on the current deal environment, how they build and navigate relationships with founders and operators, and what they expect in the second half of the year and early into 2027. Again, just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So I think Jeff got us kicked off in part A. So Eric, I'm going to come to you first on this question. So the past 18 to 24 months have been challenging across the board with compressed exits, cautious LPs, and slower deployment. So my question to you is, where's Trident finding the best risk-adjusted opportunities right now? And what's your approach to pacing in the current environment?
Sure. And thank you so much, Todd and the BDO team. Just very much appreciate you guys doing this and having me aboard once again.
You bet.
From a pacing perspective, the answer is easy. We don't change the way we pace due to the environment. We've been called grumpy underwriters historically. I take that as a compliment because our process doesn't start with deals. It starts with finding operators who then lead us down these paths to build really great theses. And from that thesis creation, we go after transactions. What I didn't say in the first episode is that process might take us 18 to 24 months. And so if you see a headline of Trident closing a deal, you know, you might think that that was 3 months of hard work. You know, yes, it was, but you might be missing the 12 to 18 months of work that went in before that, just to know that that is where we wanted to be. And so because that process is so long-winded, there are years where we don't get a lot done and maybe the market is, you know, piping hot. And then there are years where we do get a lot done and, you know, the market's a little bit weaker. This is one of those years where, you know, we're frankly just chock full of opportunities. But again, all of those processes started a year or more ago in many cases. That's the first thing I'll say. The second thing I'll say is sort of where are we looking? You know, right now, I said in the first episode, we like the most, you know, the red-blooded American companies. You know, we're looking sort of in the most red-blooded of the red-blooded places these days. You know, we're looking at the laundry space right now, rolling up laundromats. We just bought a plumbing business very recently, which has been growing rather nicely. So these are spaces that we know private equity has looked at in the past. But what we did is we spent a lot of time really trying to understand why these opportunities still exist and what private equity might have missed historically. And if you look a little closer, you'll find in many of these sectors that technology has actually started to shift the ability of these businesses to be investable. And so that's one thing that we spend a lot of time focusing on. There are certain businesses where it's very hard to diligence them, but then a piece of technology may come about that all of a sudden makes them diligenceable. For example, historically, laundromats were very difficult for private equity firms to invest in. We have spent an enormous amount of time looking at the sector, and there's actually now an ability for you to properly vet the amount of revenue that an owner might be showing you. Why? Because there's technology that's integrated into laundry machines these days that actually monitors how many times that laundry machine will turn. And so historically, you'd have to sit there with a counter and count how many people walked in and out of that laundromat or trust the owner or make estimates based on how much detergent they were selling. I mean, there were sort of ways to back into it, but no way to really be sure. And just in the last 5 to 7 years, your ability to be sure about a simple number like revenue has totally shifted. So that's just a minor example, but that happens across multiple different industries where your ability to diligence and be sure changes. And so we try to be aware of those sort of fulcrum points and invest when appropriate.
Appreciate that laundromat example. Very insightful. And Eric, welcome back to the podcast. Great to have you. So Jeff, I'm going to pivot to you. How is Bruin going about things right now with exits remaining tight and capital deployment more measured than in prior years? Where are you finding the best risk-adjusted opportunities today? And I guess the second part is, how has that environment influenced your investment pacing?
Yeah, thanks, Todd, for having me again.
Yep.
I'd echo to start what Eric said, which is we have years where we'll do zero platform investments and are focused on the portfolio, whether that's because we've got a lot of action at the portfolio or because we just don't see opportunities we like. And then years where we will deploy $300 or $400 million in a year and do four platform investments. So it's not always linear and consistent. So we don't get too hung up in a given year if there's not a lot of activity. We still are seeing this year a very strong volume of high quality business, notwithstanding some of the broader market challenges and distractions. Our companies, we think, and the ones that we're looking at for exits have a lot of strategic and sponsor interest. And certainly some of the processes we're looking at seem to be robust. I think certain companies with a story or some issues are definitely tougher in a market like this. For example, anything with vertical software or an AI risk or a challenging cash flow profile, if they have a lot of CapEx where the ROI isn't clear in this market that has some headwinds or uncertainty, I think some of those businesses with a little bit of a story or theoretical risk that's hard to dispel or tricky. But for quality businesses, we're seeing strong activity and interest both with our buyer and seller hat on. Even businesses that sometimes have a little bit of a story sometimes creates an opportunity for us or an arbitrage as tuck-in acquisitions, since for us, if we're able to realize some synergies, the tuck-ins don't need to be perfect. We've done, I think, 14 platform acquisitions, but over 50 total acquisitions in the portfolio because we're very focused on tuck-in. So sometimes in a more challenging market environment, we're able to focus more on the portfolio and tuck-ins and value creation, even if the platform opportunities aren't robust. So our pipeline is strong. I'd say maybe there's slightly fewer banker processes. Some of those we see are getting pushed. A lot of the businesses we've been tracking for a while, despite our efforts to kind of go bilateral that are going to run a process regardless, we're seeing those get pushed a little bit. But our bilateral deal flow is pretty strong. And we're selective anyway. We spend time on the businesses we've been tracking for a long time and businesses we understand and can move the needle on. I'd say we're also very conservative on leverage. We're not looking to max leverage or generate really returns from leverage. We're underwriting to strong growth and that Bruin value add. Our leverage typically 3.5 to 4.5 times profile. And so interest rate environment hasn't really impacted us at all in terms of ability to finance deals or meaningfully move the needle on our underwriting case or our returns. I wouldn't say we've changed our pace or investment approach at all from the current environment. Again, you can't ignore the market when some of the businesses we look at are software enabled. You have to kind of understand what AI risk is, for example. But outside of some of those types of more market consistent risks, we're not seeing much of a change to our approach. And we're also looking at, and Eric kind of hit on this as well, old school kind of traditional private equity businesses, real picks and shovels in sports. So in infrastructure or industrial businesses that serve the sports space. So we see a lot of opportunities even kind of in hardware or infrastructure or services to stadiums that are interesting right now because of the proliferation and growth of stadiums globally. And a lot of new stadiums are growing up, stadiums are being renovated, making that in-stadium experience a lot more attractive because the TV experience has gotten so good. So, leagues and teams are looking to bring people back into the seats and make sure they're selling the seats. So there's a lot of innovation in stadiums and you need that infrastructure to support the growth of that stadium. So what'll look like an industrial business will look at it as a sports business. And we're seeing a lot of really interesting activity in kind of that unsexy infrastructure space. But on the other hand, we recently invested in a business called Matchroom Sport with the Hearn family. It's a pure IP business that sells tickets, puts on events, media rights, sponsorship, licensing, So there's a variety of deal flow. So we cast that kind of wide net across sports as an end market. So we're still seeing a pretty robust pipeline at the moment.
All right, good stuff, Jeff, and welcome back to the podcast. So, guys, we've talked about sourcing deals and creating value, but ultimately execution comes down to people. Both of you work closely with founders and operators after you made an investment, and in both of your markets, those relationships can make or break the outcome for certain. So, what's the most important thing you've learned about making those partnerships actually work? And is there anything you do now that you wish you had done from the start? Jeff, why don't you kick us off here?
We've certainly had some learnings. I'd say the most critical thing is to be on the same page going into a deal on the strategy. You need to let the team and the management team do the execution and the tactics, and you might not always agree on the way to get from point A to point B, but you need to know what point A and point B is, and you need to have that alignment before you make the investment. You know, going in, it's too difficult if you don't agree on the strategy going in. So that's a pretty clear 90-day plan, initial budget, a 3-year growth plan. And then if you agree on that initial strategy, you're meeting over time just to check in on the markers. Obviously, you're course correcting over time as things change, but that upfront alignment with the founder and the management team is critical. It can be really easy to just kind of focus on diligence and deal execution and getting the deal across the line. And you sign, you close, and then you look at each other and you're building the plan from there. But you know, you're already behind, and a marker in our world, like it or not, is IRR, and time's important. So you want to get off to a quick start, but more important than that is you really need that alignment up front, an understanding of what post-deal looks like, how decisions are made, what's the communication cadence, how to prioritize different growth opportunities. A lot of the businesses we're looking at are middle market or lower middle market, and they don't have unlimited resources or unlimited management bandwidth. So you need to kind of prioritize the growth opportunities and have alignment between us and the management teams there. And if we're aligned on that, it's hard to get off sides. Management also, and we convey this really early, can't be afraid to deliver bad news or ask for help. It's really interesting working on global deals. There's certain cultural stereotypes that often prove to be true, where I think some people in some markets are more open, and then other times the tendency you see is to kind of hide bad news. So for us, it's critical to, you know, foster environment of trust and to make sure they feel like if something does go wrong, they're calling us. If the boat is sinking or the boat has a hole that needs to be plugged, we want to be on the boat with the team helping to fix it. We don't want to get a phone call when, you know, the boat's already in the bottom of the ocean. So we really convey that level of trust and transparency and look at us as a partner. We're not going to wag our finger at you and tell you how to run your business that you've been running forever. Creating that initial trust early on is important. And it's better to over-communicate, especially in the first year of the new investment. We feel like we can't spend enough time in person together. And, you know, you kind of get lost in the trap of Zooms and 30-minute Zooms, 1-hour Zooms, 2-hour meetings. Nothing beats spending 2 days with someone. So we'll do offsites for, you know, you meet in the afternoon for meetings, do a dinner, meet again the next morning for lunch. You really find out a lot and get a feel for the human element and people and what motivates them when you're kind of distraction-free spending a day and a half with them versus spending, you know, 2 hours on a Zoom once a week. It's just a different cadence and focus level. So in-person meetings over a longer period of time, we've started to do a lot more. The other thing we've learned is we really do try to avoid changes to the team. Like I said, we're partnering with management teams. We want to keep the existing teams in place, but often a team needs to be added. And if you kick the can down the road and don't hit it head on, you always end up regretting it. So, you know, to support a growth business, you might need a COO or a chief growth officer, or kind of C-suite type person that may not have been there before. The founder CEO might be reticent at first to bring someone new from the outside that can have a large impact on the business. First, maybe they want to promote from below, but that person below who they're loyal to might not be the right person. So you need to really have that alignment on the personnel decisions as well. Oftentimes, we're underwriting to a lot of M&A, so you need an M&A person or a corp dev person to really mind the world if there's going to be a big M&A strategy. So we want it to be collaborative. We don't want to get into an investment where, you know, the CEO or the founder is super resistant to making those type of changes. So agreeing to what you need up front is important, and you don't want to kick the can down the road on some of those personnel changes or enhancements that are needed.
Yeah, love that feedback. A lot of good sound bites, and I a big believer in doing things in person. I think it's much more efficient and has a lot of impact. So appreciate all those thoughts. So Eric, I'll turn it over to you now. What separates the most successful investor operator partnerships from the rest? And is there anything you've incorporated into your approach over time that you wish you'd been doing since day one?
Yeah. We buy such great businesses, but I think it's important sometimes to distinguish between a hustle and a business. And what we're really trying to do is take a business or, a hustle in some cases and turn it into a business. And I just qualify the difference between the two is, if the top one or two or three guys or gals get, hit by a bus tomorrow, does this business continue to be successful? That transition can be incredibly painful. It can be incredibly time consuming, and it can bruise a lot of egos. We are professional feather rufflers here at Trident because we know that that transition is going to be so critical. But we also know that it's going to mean slight changings of roles and responsibilities, narrowing of roles and responsibilities or focuses as we expand. Rapport is the most important thing. You want to find great managers who are passionate, who understand the sector, et cetera. But a good rule of thumb for me is anybody who you're working with relatively closely, where you're working on something critical, call them like you call your mom. Literally, just pick up the phone and give them a call on a random Tuesday at a random time and just say, "What's up? What's going on?" Not everything needs to be scheduled and organized because if the only times that we're interfacing are about specific things, then we're only going to talk about those specific things. And that could actually be a real detriment to a business. When I think about my partners here at Trident, we don't schedule our time to talk. We just talk whenever we have something to talk about. And that's ideally, I think, the kind of relationship that you want to have with any operator. You want to be able to just pick up the phone and talk, and whatever comes up, comes up. Obviously, you're going to have your weekly meetings and your monthly recaps and your scheduled board meetings quarterly. All that stuff comes with the territory. But sometimes it's what's unsaid at those meetings that can help you properly direct a business. Feelings about different employees. That also lets you know if there are things that might be straining trust, either between the sponsor and the management team, between the management team and some of the junior employees, between some of the junior employees and the private equity firm. I mean, these are large, growing, dynamic businesses. And to think that there are not going to be the strains or difficulties as you're trying to grow it amidst potentially bumpy roads is a little bit naive. And so for me, rapport is the number one thing. You really just want to have the type of relationship where you can, pick up the phone and just chat. That's where I think some of the best details come out.
Yeah. Eric, I got to tell you, you've been dropping a lot of gems, but call them like you call your mom. It's fantastic. I talk to my mom all the time, and she never has any idea when the call is coming. So that's fantastic. So sadly, this is going to be our last question with Jeff and Eric. As usual, I like to end by asking you both my classic crystal ball question. So, Eric, I'm going to come to you first. Looking ahead, the sectors you invest in are evolving rapidly, creating both new opportunities and new challenges for investors and operators alike. So as you look to the second half of 2026 and into 2027, I'd like to know what it is that keeps you up at night about private equity and really where your sector's headed.
I think in general, it's fairly clear that LPs are starting to wake up to how attractive the lower middle market is, or at least going smaller, right? And I think that's positively affecting, everybody on this call. I do worry about the lack of DPI in private equity. We've got a 22 vintage fund that's been able to return, 0.2, 0.3x DPI, which is high relative to our market. But the fact that that is high, the fact that we are, you know, so well outpacing the market is a good thing in some ways, but it's kind of not, because it means that getting recycled capital in to private equity is going to be very difficult. And what that means effectively is that it's going to slow the pace of money flowing into the best and most efficient places. It means that money's going to be stuck in inefficient places. And I think the onus is going to be on both the LPs and us, the GPs, to really unblock the market here, because it will help us all in the long term. You know, we're all like crabs in a bucket right now, crawling all over each other, but somebody is going to have to sell. And yes, I know you don't want to sell for a 1.5x, but if it's going to take you another 3 or 4 or 5 years to get to a 2x, just so you can say you had a 2x, while there are great businesses that you could be reinvesting that capital into, you know, frankly, we all just need to grow up a little bit. And I'm not talking as somebody who has not had that experience. I know what that's like, but I can tell you it's been very good for me to take capital out of, for instance, the healthcare services world, which has got a lot more competitive in those healthcare services roll-ups, and deploy it into logistics and transportation, which is having a tailwind, particularly at, you know, for tuck-ins for what is my best performing company in my portfolio. And so that's really our jobs, to think of how to not just actively deploy capital, but pick and choose exactly where that capital should be deployed at certain periods over the life cycle of an economy. And, you know, we're not hedge funds, so I'm not saying to buy and sell things willy-nilly, but we do need to be a little bit more honest with ourselves about how efficient we're actually being. And that pressure needs to come from the LPs, but it also needs to come from GPs. So that really worries me as a general trend, because I think it negatively affects all of us, everybody in the ecosystem.
Yeah, good point. I appreciate that, Eric. So Jeff, what's your take? Obviously, you're focused on a different sector than Eric, but looking ahead to the rest of the year and into 2027, again, what are you most cautious or concerned about when it comes to private equity and where your industry is headed? And what are your thoughts on what's to come?
Yeah, so I think just to start, there's a lot more to be excited about than to be concerned about as we support these services and tech and media and infrastructure businesses that power global sport. We love to see continued growth in sports overall, which is what we continue to see even after 12 years, new and emerging sports, sports becoming more international, new stadiums, and stadium innovation in tech is a huge area of focus. Just growth overall, the industry and major sports properties within media and sponsorship and Gain International. So there's a lot of things to be excited about. Most important, I think, it's the one thing maybe besides, you know, news or weather that just brings that live audience together. And it's almost tribal, whether you look at college sports or soccer in Europe. Fandom is tribal and growing and will continue to do so in terms of viewership, attendance, merchandise. Just sports elicits passion and an interest at an individual and grassroots level, unlike anything else, both in terms of participation at the youth level and then in terms of fandom as well. So all of that stuff, kind of all of those tailwinds and that headroom in the space creates a lot of opportunities for the companies we invest in. And there still is, for as large as it's grown and high as team valuations have gone and media rights continue to grow, there's still a ton of growth opportunities. European soccer doing more in the U.S., growth of soccer overall in the U.S., particularly with the World Cup right now. Women's sports is really having a moment, finally well-deserved and long overdue in terms of development of the revenue opportunities and sponsorship and fandom of women's sports and viewership is growing a lot. It was behind for a while in terms of the venue and the infrastructure and the training and performance centers that you saw in men's sports, but women's sports is catching up in a lot of ways there. Sponsors are drawn to it. It's got a very good demographic. So there's a lot to be excited about in terms of concerns. As you look at kind of our little world of sports-based private equity, it is getting more crowded. You read a lot about new sports funds being launched. I'm not sure everyone will be successful. There's a lot of money coming into the space. When you unpack it, most are quite different than Bruin. A lot of them are doing investments in teams or investments in debt or hybrid or venture or growth equity. And there's not that there's anything wrong with that, but our focus is a little bit different. So we still think we're unique, but there is a lot of money coming into the ecosystem. I'm not sure all the investments will be successful. I think that creates some LP confusion. So that's, you know, a concern more from a future fundraising perspective. But again, I think we have a differentiated approach and very good track record. And the other area I'd point to, I know it's a little cliche, but you know, the AI impact on a lot of the more software driven businesses that we've looked at in the past. I think AI will create a lot more good than bad overall, but certainly will create a lot of disruption. And it's just one of those things when you're sitting in an investment committee, it's really hard to dispel theoretical risk or predict what type of software business has enough services layers and white glove that it won't be as disrupted from an AI native software business. But there's a lot of, you know, businesses we probably would have been, you know, jumping in head first 5 years ago to look at that right now. You just have to be a little bit more cautious on just because you don't know the impact necessarily in the medium term. So a couple of concerns, but overall, we feel like a lot more to be excited about in our world.
All right. Love the optimism. And thanks for wrapping us on the topic. So unfortunately, guys, that's all we have for episode today. So to our listeners, if you want to hear more from Jeff and Eric, highly recommend giving Part A a listen if you haven't already. It's an excellent companion to today's conversation. And I, you know, we really appreciate Jeff and Eric taking time to join us for both parts. You know, very thoughtful perspectives. You both are super busy, but you know, on behalf of all of BDO, we value our relationships with both your firms, Bruin Capital and Trident, and can't thank you enough for being on the pod today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us, Todd.
Thanks so much to BDO and Todd in particular for doing this. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys. So to our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in.
If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.